the books have little golden spines, nameplates on the front page, and usually no author or illustrator credits on their covers. When other children's picture books cost $2 and $3, the little golden books with titles like The Pokey Little Puppy and Three Little Kittens cost just 50 cents. Now, art from this beloved brand will be featured in an exhibit opening Friday, July 4th at the Children's Museum of Manhattan. It's called Golden Legacy, original art from 65 years of golden books, and its curators are Leonard S. Marcus and Diane Muldrow. Mr. Marcus also wrote the book Golden Legacy, How Golden Books Won Children's Hearts, Changed Publishing Forever, and Became an American Icon Along the Way. I'm very pleased that all of this has brought Mr. Marcus to the show today. Hi.
I'm glad to be here.
Golden Books were launched in 1942, which was the first full year of America's involvement in World War II. What was the impetus for their creation?
Well, they were a number of years in the making. They were created by two groups of people, one a printing company called Western based in the Midwest, and the other Simon & Schuster. Their idea was to democratize publishing for children, to make books more accessible than they had been before, in part by bringing down the price, as you've already mentioned, and also by just making them available in places where parents frequented, such as five and dime stores, rather than the august bookstores, which were only found in large cities anyway.
And they were different in other ways. As I said, there were no author's credits. They had those hard covers, but they weren't the thickest books around.
Simon & Schuster had originated pocketbooks for adults a few years earlier, an incredibly popular line of paperback books that cost 25 cents. It was another example of how they were trying to reach as many people as possible, making book ownership a reality for them. And Golden, they were very market savvy, so they focused not so much on who the individual author was as on creating an image for the line as a whole.
But they were also in color, and color printing is more expensive than black and white.
Well, that's where Western came in, because they operated on a very large scale, and because of economies of scale, were able to help keep the price down, too.
So that's why you write, this is a tale of two cities, New York and Racine, Wisconsin. That's where mm-hmm. Western was?
That's right. And, you know, the traditional publishers, because of the high cost of color printing, tended to have even their best illustrators work in black and white a fair amount of the time. I mean, think of Make Way for Ducklings, for example, which was published right around the same time as the first Golden Books. So one of the big lures of working for Golden Books for artists was the chance to let it all out with color. And Garth Williams, for example, who everyone will know as the illustrator of Charlotte's Web and the Little House books, got to work in full color when he did Golden Books, and that's the thing that he really loved about it.
Was Simon & Schuster a new company at the time?
They started in the 20s, and they were founded by two young men who were Jewish and, as such, had no hope of getting a job at one of the traditional literary houses in New York. So they decided to go into business for themselves, and they had kind of an upstart attitude and wanted to sort of loosen things up in the publishing world, and they succeeded in doing that.
Well, there were the big little books that preceded mm-hmm. the Golden Books. How are they linked?
Well, they were a creation of the other partner, the Western Printing Company, which was very entrepreneurial, and they saw that comic strips were a great draw for kids. And the big little books were basically comic strips transformed into book form. These little chunky books that measured maybe 3 or 4 inches on either side and cost only a dime and were sold in the hundreds of thousands in five and dime stores. So they came along right at the same time that the first comic books do, and they were kind of a rival format. Comic books probably won out in the long run, but they were both very popular at the beginning.
And as you said, the Golden Books were made available in places where people normally wouldn't buy books. Mm-hmm. This was important because people who didn't go into bookstores were buying books for their kids. So this is a major breakthrough. We wish there was more of that happening right now.
Well, that's right. Yeah, it. You know, people would, I think, feel they weren't educated enough to go into some of the better bookstores, whereas here the pressure was completely off. The price was low enough so that if a child, you know, passing through a store with a mother who was looking for needles and thread happened to spot one of these shiny little books on a rack, you know, and pulled it off the rack, the mother would say, oh, it's just a quarter. Why not?
So they were doing very well?
They were doing incredibly well.
What about the critics? Were the critics happy with them?
At the beginning, no. Parents loved them, but the librarians were invested in an idea of the book beautiful for young children. They wanted picture books to be aesthetically uplifting objects, sort of like a step on the way to visiting the Metropolitan Museum. And there was something to be said for that. And the books that tended to win the Caldecott Medal fell into that category. They were often exquisite visual productions. But, of course, kids have sticky fingers, and occasionally they drop their favorite books in the bathtub. And so on a practical level, Golden Books had very realistic appeal for lots of people.
Why did so many of the authors come from Europe?
Well, there was a tremendous influx of talented people of all kinds in the run-up to World War II. And, the New School was founded by intellectuals who were in that situation. And Tibor Gergely, who was a Hungarian Jew, had to flee political repression as the war was beginning. Fyodor Rozhenkovsky was a Russian who came by way of Paris and also was looking for freedom, basically. So that was one group who became involved in.
And were they drawing upon the folk tales of their homelands?
To some extent, I think just in general on a tradition of storytelling, illustrated storytelling for children. Gergely had been a serious painter and political caricaturist in Hungary. And to some extent, when he came to America, he put that behind him. He couldn't find a gallery, for instance, that would show his paintings. But he did tend to illustrate books that celebrated the working man and woman in America, things like The Five Little Firemen, which show working-class people racing to the rescue of their neighbors. So he was able, in an indirect way, to express his deepest political feelings, really.
Some of these books have become classics, and you wonder why they caught on so quickly, Three Little Kittens and The Pokey Little Puppy.
Well, you can never be entirely sure. The Pokey Little Puppy was illustrated by Gustav Tengren, who was one of several Disney artists who came east immediately after World War II.
And later there was a Disney link.
That's right. Yeah, Disney ended up licensing his characters to generate money to feed the movie production, which was always very expensive, and Golden had the lock on those books for many years. But Tengren also created the characters of the Seven Dwarfs, and in a way the puppies are the Seven Dwarfs with floppy ears and tails. That the appeal, the charm of those characters, I think partly accounts for the popularity of that book. And it's in a way it's a classic story of the little guy pulling up the rear and still having a place in the world. That's the little puppy is the one who ends up being identified with by children.
We're still seeing that story told in different variations.
Oh yeah, it was one of the very first 12 little golden books, and it has always been the most popular one.
Do you think that to some degree what we're seeing on children's television today is an updated version of the Golden Books?
You could say that. Certainly what they offered at the beginning is not unique in the way that it was back in the 1940s. Another thing that happened along the way was the advent of paperback picture books for kids, which meant that there were more choices in the way of less expensive illustrated books for young people.
Go ahead.
I would certainly agree that all the interest in animation for kids is an updated attempt to do basically the same thing.
And they tell stories about little locomotives that that wind up doing the job that the big ones can't do.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's that just has appeal, sort of universal appeal for kids wanting to feel that they, as the little ones in the world, have a real place.
Were the Golden Books the first brand to have a name plaque on the front page?
I have a feeling that some people thought of that before, but they were so systematic about bringing together all the elements that would maximize the appeal of this of the line. I mean, there was that which gave the child, a real sense of ownership and connection to the book as a treasured object. Then in the back, they would list all the other books in the line, and each was numbered so that it brought out the collector's instinct. And I had a number of these books when I was growing up, and I kept them all together on my shelf. And I would wonder, in my four-year-old state of confusion, whether the golden, the tinsel was actually real gold. And I thought maybe it was, and this was my treasure.
My guest is Leonard S. Marcus, who's co-curator of the exhibit Golden Legacy, original art from 65 years of golden books, which opens at the Children's Museum of Manhattan this coming Friday, July 4th, and runs through August 28th. And by the way, you can see some of these things on a slideshow that we posted on our show page at WNYC.org. Mr. Marcus has also written a beautiful book called Golden Legacy, How Golden Books Won Children's Hearts, Changed Publishing Forever, and Became an American Icon Along the Way, in a celebration of the 65 years of the Golden Books. And it has an introduction by Eric Carle. And that makes sense to me because Eric Carle seems to be, to me anyway, someone who has inherited some of that Golden Book sensibility.
Right. Well, his art is a kind of lingua franca, which is enjoyed by children all around the world. And one of the main impulses of behind the Golden Books was always to find stories and images that would have as general appeal for young kids as possible. And it so happens that he grew up on the Big Little Book, so there was that sort of historical connection too.
There are some other people who played important roles. Mary Read from Columbia University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the editors who created Golden Books wanted to give it the patina of respectability, so they sought out experts who would say, yes, this is really good for children. And Mary Read was one of the innovators in early education in America, so her stamp of approval was kind of like the good housekeeping seal of approval. At least that was the hope.
And she obviously was right because it did have an impact on literacy rates.
Well, sure, because the more expensive picture books tended to be printed in quantities of 5 or 10 or 15,000, whereas Golden Books would be printed in quantities of 50 or 100,000. So just the reach of these books was incredible.
So is that why the subtitle of your book includes "It Changed Publishing Forever"?
Yes, that's exactly
Simon
right.
Simon & Schuster changed as a result of this?
I think it impressed a lot of people that there was money to be made in children's books and that there were new ways of reaching children's books. It was really a sort of a cottage industry in a backwater, operating in a sort of genteel sensibility up until that time. And after Golden Books came along, other publishers began to think about, well, how can we reach more of America, more than the 10 or 20% that was already buying books?
There were also some pretty impressive people who contributed, Mary Wise Brown, Richard Scarry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Margaret Wise Brown was, I think, the great poet for very young children. She's best known for a book which was not a Golden Book called Goodnight Moon. But she loved the idea of not just writing books, but having children actually read them. And she saw Golden Books as a chance to reach the largest possible audience.
How did they adjust to the changes in society? For example, I mean, the first Golden Books in 1942, when America mm-hmm. was a segregated society. Mm-hmm. What happened when attitudes started changing?
Well, in the 60s, there was a great awakening on the part of the publishing world in general for children, because it had been essentially an all-white world, both on the side of who was working in publishing and on the side of the images that were being put out of life in America.
And it was also a bit of a sexist world.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was, I guess, recognized a little bit later. Richard Scarry's most popular book was called The Best Word Book Ever, and it came out in 63 originally. And it was a book with bunny characters, but the male bunnies were going to work and driving cars, and the female bunnies were cooking the dinner at home. And because it was so popular, it became a lightning rod for criticism, starting, I think, in the 70s in particular, when the women's movement really gained a head of steam. And so Scarry felt compelled eventually to redo some of the pictures to bring them more in line with our better idea of what society is like.
And wasn't there also a suggestion that tints be put on children's faces so that the books could be integrated without chasing readers away in the South?
That's right. That's right. Well, that was, I think, always the great impediment for children's book publishers, apart from whatever their personal prejudices may have been, to showing a multiracial view of American society in picture book art. The fear that the Southern constituency, the bookstores, would boycott. I mean, it's a horrible legacy, but it happens to be true. Would boycott the publishers if they began publishing books with children of color pictured in them.
We have to ask Barack Obama if he ever read them when he was a kid.
It'd be very interesting to find out. You know, Garth Williams, that illustrator we talked about before, did a book called The Rabbit's Wedding in 1959, I think it was, and it showed a black rabbit and a white rabbit falling in love and marrying each other, and it was banned in the South. I mean, it was caused a real furor. It's a sad thing to realize.
A listener wants to know if there's any relation to Golden Records.
Yes. Golden Records was created by the same people as Golden Books, and the theory was that the mother was home in the afternoon cooking dinner for the family and didn't have as much time as the children would want to be reading to them. So why not put some of those stories on record so the kids could listen to them over and over themselves? It didn't take off to quite the extent that Golden Books did, but probably nothing could have because they were so popular.
Well, Golden Books have gone through some tough times. Now published by Random House, not Simon & Schuster anymore?
That's right, yeah. Random House got out of it many years ago in the early 60s, and then Western became the sole owner for many years. They, for about 30 or so years, they couldn't do anything wrong. Then they got top-heavy as a company and lost direction, went into bankruptcy two or three times. And now, about 5 or 6 years ago, Random House took over. They're trying to revitalize it, and they seem to really appreciate the value of the old classics, at least some of those. Many of them carry over very nicely into the present.
Well, it seems to me the thing that they have to do is figure a way to get them to the kids again, mm-hmm. because retail has changed so much.
That's true. Though, in a way, it's moved in the direction that Golden Books had been pursuing all along.
Leonard S. Marcus is curator of the exhibit Golden Legacy, original art from 65 years of Golden Books. It opens at the Children's Museum of Manhattan this Friday, July 4th. And remember, we have a slideshow on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.